Welcome back, everybody, to our common thread. For April's episode, we're sitting down with three ladies who work for the department. They're all super great at what they do. And as many of you probably know, April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. And so this month, that's what we're focused on. And we're really going to dive into what kind of trends we're seeing right now, what our prevention team at CD is doing to really combat those, and just the overall health of our child welfare system. So I think we'll start by going around and letting everyone introduce themselves. Haley, if you'd like to start.
I am Haley Musso. I am with the State Technical Assistance Team, and I manage the Child Fatality Review Program for the state.
I'm Kara Wilcox, and I am a unit manager in Children's Division Central Office, and I oversee policy and programming around our child abuse and neglect investigations and assessments.
Good morning. I'm Elaine Castile. I am a senior program specialist in our prevention unit, and I oversee our sort of our primary prevention efforts as well as our secondary and tertiary prevention efforts as well, internal efforts around prevention, as well as some contracts with some of our community partners that provide both primary and secondary prevention.
Great. Well, thank you three for joining me today. I'm really excited about this episode. So I think we'll just dive on in. I think to set the tone and to really be able to build off of the conversation, I would like to start with asking, what are some trends that we're seeing? What are things looking like? What are some things that that we as a team here at the Department of Social Services really need to pay attention to? And then, of course, on the other side of that, really try to educate the public on how we can prevent those incidents.
Yeah, so something that I always like to highlight during Child Abuse Prevention Month is safe sleep. When we talk about preventable fatalities, that's the number one. Our annual report was put out at the end of last year for 2022, and there were 103 infant deaths marked as sleep-related by our local panels. That number is staggering when you think about the fact that all of those are preventable. Further, 66% of those infants were sleep surface sharing, or sharing a sleep surface with somebody else. So again, we really want to get the message out there. Do not sleep with your babies. They need to be alone on their backs and in their own crib. Nothing else in the crib. You often hear a naked crib, just the fitted sheet. You can put the baby in a sleep sack. Again, these are preventable. And I think that that's the biggest message I want to get out, is that every year we see a ridiculous number of these that are completely preventable. And then outside of the sleep-related fatalities, another thing that I think it's important for this group to talk about is deaths related to fentanyl. I think a lot of people have heard in the news recently, fentanyl feels like a buzzword, I think. And I think it's really important to bring awareness to what fentanyl means, right? And what fentanyl means to our communities and our kids. So in 2022, we had 43 fentanyl-related deaths of children. Those ages range from under one all the way up to 17. And I think, you know, it, again, the buzzword seems to be fentanyl. But I think when you dig into that a little bit, it's really more about the culture of drug use and what we can do to get services to those who are struggling with substance use addiction issues, and really, you know, being thoughtful and getting these people what they need versus, you know, making the assumption that they've just made a poor, negligent decision that affected their kid, but really, you know, linking that service and getting them the help that they need. And so those are really the two that I wanted to focus on today. And I think, again, our annual report is out there for everybody to view. One thing that I always like to talk about again is suicides. Those are also preventable. We see a number of those every year. Being cognizant of older youth and everything that affects them and linking them, you know, themselves to mental health services as well. So,
yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the update there. And I think, you know, one thing that particularly stands out to me is the safe sleep desks. I know that's something that we really try to hit hard on every year. And I just think, you know, now is our time to really to try to be proactive and prevent those from ever occurring or even being on the verge of happening. So last month's podcast episode was about maternal and infant health initiatives going on in the department right now. The department launched a website along with MHD a while back called Healthy Moms, Healthy Babies. And there's definitely a lot of resources there on that website that could be so helpful. And maybe it's a matter of, you know, the family needing healthcare assistance to where we can come into play, or it's a matter of, you know, them needing nutritional assistance. We can help with that. But I think there's still a huge amount of resources that are not with the department. So partners that we work with that people don't know about. And I don't think our team members fully know about either. I mean, I know I'm sure there's plenty that I don't know about. So I think Elaine and Kara, if there's any resources that you could talk about, that what they could be our resources or they could be partnerships with external stakeholders. I would love to hear about those and love to get those out into the field. And it doesn't have to just be like safe sleep resources. I definitely like the fentanyl and the suicides in older youth. Those are both just as equally important as the safe sleep.
As you were talking about the website, we have two different safe sleep trainings that we have available for our staff. There's an advanced one, there's a general one, and more advanced one. And one of them, if not both of them, is also intended to be used to be able to show caregivers in the moment. And so I'm wondering if that's a place too that we could link that training resource to for the public to see. That was one thing that stood out for me, for sure.
Add to that. And Bailey, one of the things that you said really stuck out to me, and that is we don't always know what those resources are. And when I'm thinking about our prevention efforts, right? So like our true primary prevention efforts, where we're trying to engage with communities to keep kids safe before they even come to the attention of the Children's Division, right? Like that is one of our goals. And part of the challenge with that is reducing the stigma of asking for help and empowering our families to be like, it's okay to say, I need a little bit of assistance. It's okay to say, I'm in a crisis right now and I need a hand up. That is one of the efforts that we're trying to really focus on. And becoming, for us, for the Children's Division, for the department to become experts in what community resources are available, part of that is really connecting with our communities in a way that they also feel like they can partner with us and assist families. In a way that really just strengthens our whole child welfare system, right? One of the ways that we do that is with our crisis care facilities. And I don't know how well known our crisis care facilities are to some of our community partners, but right now we have 7 facilities across the state that we partner with. And I know there are also other kind of crisis shelters for families that are available that aren't even necessarily contracted with the state, but those facilities are available to families to go to when they are meeting a crisis. So I'm thinking about those moms who are just feeling completely overwhelmed, right? I tell a personal story in some of our trainings that we do. I had a child with colic who cried a lot, and I was a brand new mom. I didn't know what to do. And if it hadn't been for people helping me, I don't know how my story would have ended, right? Because you just never know in that moment what's going to happen. And those preventable deaths, the shaken baby, the preventable death of, you know, doing safe sleep with your kids, because sometimes you're just tired and you fall asleep and you just don't do what's the right thing to do for your kiddos. Our crisis care facilities can really help, and getting the word out to go and ask for that help before your crisis turns into a safety concern for your kiddos is just so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important too. Like, we live in a society where co-sleeping has been made into a huge phenomenon. I am not a mother, but I do have a lot of family, and I'm also a huge TikToker, like, you know, just like anyone else, TikToks consume my life. And, you know, I see a lot of times where you have young mothers on TikTok that are co-sleeping, and it's scary, right? And a lot of times in the comments, you do have people that are saying, like, I get it, you know, you want to have that like close connection with your baby, or you're overwhelmed and you're just tired and you will do anything to get some sleep, but it's not safe. And so I am seeing, like, I do see that a lot out in the public and just like outside of our world, right? But I think it's important to explain the why, and maybe as a group, like, we can explain to our team members here, like, why is that not safe? I assume, you know, a lot of CD workers probably know that, right? And I'm sure a lot of our FSD and our MHD, like, employees, they know that also. But there's still some that don't, and that's okay. And that's why we're here. And so I just wanted to take a minute, like, to explain why it's not safe.
Yeah, so I can absolutely do that. There are a number of ways that these fatalities happen, especially when you're talking about sleep surface sharing. So Bailey, you mentioned TikTok, and like, I think a big thing on there is like your home and like cleaning your home and home decor, or at least that's what I see. And so you know, a lot of us have these big, nice duvets or comforter sets and nice pillows, or like the special fluffy pillow to keep your neck up or whatever. And, you know, those things are easy for a baby to become entangled in and block their airways from them getting oxygen. And then we have something that's called rebreathing. So we're rebreathing the carbon dioxide that they breathe out. Does that make sense? And so then the baby's not getting the oxygen that they need. And so that would be called, you know, entangled in the bedding or things like that. And then there's something that's called overlay. And I am a mom, and I am chronically tired. I think it just comes with being a mom, or at least that's what I've experienced. And sometimes when I go to sleep, I go to sleep. Okay. It's long and it's hard because I'm exhausted. And you know, that can happen unintentionally, right? And then you roll over onto the child, suffocating the child. And then, you know, when you think about some of the other modalities of the way these happen and the importance of being in a crib on a flat surface, a lot of the fatalities that we see can happen in some of these nice fancy bouncy seats or swings that are marketed to tired moms that just want their kids to sleep, right? And so the position that they have the infant in is one that's at kind of an angle. And because Infants are born with such massive heads and little bodies. Neck strength is a huge thing, right? You're always like, oh, watch the baby's head. That's something people always say when they're handing their baby off. The infant can become in what we call a flex position that has their chin to their chest, and it really just completely cuts off the airway of that child. And so I think when you talk about the modalities of how this can happen, it really highlights to me why it's important that they sleep in their own sleep space. And I think it's important also, and we've alluded to it earlier, but there are so many things that can go into making that choice, right? I'm exhausted. I don't have support. I was just up all night before this, or the baby didn't nap, and now we're overtired, and now we can't get to sleep. And so really, you know, like Elaine said, changing the culture, being a culture to reach out for help, and also being the people. So one thing that I like to push on people when we talk about this issue is for you to see your place in this issue. And if that's leaving a comment on a TikTok, like, hey, this is really dangerous, that this number of kids died due to that last year, then that's your role. If you just got, you know, a relative of yours just had a baby, talk to them about safe sleep and safe sleep practices. If you know the neighbor just had a baby and maybe they have limited supports, go offer, hey, if you have a hard night, I my kids are older, I'm happy to sit with you and your baby to make sure everything's safe. And so I think, you know, not only the why, but also where do I fit in this? And I think that's really important, especially for staff. You know, CD staff, we have all this training. You know, we have the brochures that they take to their house, right? But all staff who interface with the public are gonna come in contact with this issue. People have babies all the time, right? And so really, where do we fit in that?
Yeah, for sure.
The other thing too that we see with some of these fatalities related to safe sleep or unsafe sleep are that those that occur with like maybe a grandparent or somebody else was watching their child. And, you know, the recommendations for how to provide a safe sleep environment to a child has changed over time, and we know more about it. So we do have, you know, those grandparents out there that maybe don't even know this is an issue at all, or, you know, they raised their children and they survived and that's fine. So making sure to have those conversations too with anybody who watches your child or, you know, is watching an infant, but not just to reach out to the parent and
for sure have
a conversation with everybody else.
Yeah, a little off topic. But like, I think that kind of goes back to, you know, the whole like RSV conversation in children of like not kissing a baby and, you know, all that comes with that. I mean, there's so many, and I've seen it firsthand with my own grandmother. She has two great granddaughters now. And that was something that like we had to kind of tell her about, like, you know, this isn't a thing anymore. And here's why. And it's not to be rude or to like to insinuate that you don't know what you're doing, but things have changed. And like, here's just an update, you know? And so I think that conversation can be the same thing as, you know, explaining to your caregivers outside of the home that, hey, this is also, you know, a problem. And I did really like what you all said about like, this is our place to say something. And so I think on that same vein, I would like to kind of shift the focus to the fentanyl deaths. I know that, again, like Haley said, fentanyl is a buzzword these days, and I think that's true. And so I think I want to just touch on, one, what are we doing as a department to really try and prevent those? And then what can we tell our team members about fentanyl that they should know that they may not know?
So recently the department has asked a group of us to get together and really review these fentanyl fatalities to see what's happening in these homes. How can we better identify these, and how are we, you know, going to be able to, on a system level, better equip our staff and the multidisciplinary team that works with our staff, our children's division staff, to keep these kids safe. And so we'll be issuing a report soon with a lot of recommendations. But I think what you'll see out of that is, you know, efforts to really marry DMH services with children's division work and you know, what's going on a local level. Does this worker that's going out to this home know what DMH services offered in her area that will help this family with this substance use problem? That's going to be a big one. I think we'll probably see a lot of strengthening around practice of the children's division when they're going to assess these homes, and really just getting training and knowledge and understanding to our team about how dangerous fentanyl is and how lethal. I think those are some things that you'll see out of that. And then, you know, as the prevention initiatives and the prevention teams expand, I think, you know, the recommendations that will come out of this group will marry very nicely with things going on in Elaine's realm.
I completely agree with that. Sorry, Kara, didn't mean to cut you off. I completely agree with that. I think that even safe sleep, deaths, fentanyl deaths, these are preventable deaths, and they're often not intentional, right? Like, we're not intending for this action to lead to the harm of a child. For safe sleep, for fentanyl use, maybe it is someone intending to use a substance, but not understanding the danger of fentanyl being present in that substance, and the immediacy of the outcome of something like that is just overwhelming. And being able to get to it from the prevention side and really just honing in on the education. Bailey, you said it earlier, like understanding the whys of why we're saying the things we're saying. It's not to be to try to tell you that you're not living your life well sometimes. It's just trying to tell you and educate you around the dangers of some of these choices based on the research that we've seen and the experiences that we've had working with these families. Getting on the front end of that before the event occurs is just so vital. And I think we're going to see a larger focus on that in our prevention work.
And I think we get, you know, questions come up, but why fentanyl? Why is fentanyl so much more concerning? And it's so much more lethal. We unfortunately get a lot of newborn crisis assessments with a lot of drug exposed infants, but really needing to take a more proactive and a reactive approach really to those fentanyl concerns when anybody's using fentanyl or alleged to be using fentanyl, really making sure that you're thoroughly, you know, assessing that situation, because the lethality of that is so high in causing deaths, and that's, you know, an increasing trend, unfortunately. Yes, we are very concerned about methamphetamines and heroin and any drug, really, but really that fentanyl piece is just because it's so dangerous, and I don't think we have done as good of a job as we could, and we will be working on that, really highlighting that within our workforce. And also we saw, you know, those fentanyl deaths come in kind of two groupings. One, really little kids that are just getting exposed because they're crawling around and, you know, putting things in their mouths like kids do. And then we're also seeing older kids who are, you know, having their own drug experimentation or drug use or mental health issues and dying from fentanyl as well. And those deaths, what we saw really in the case reviews we did was the need to do intervention for that child and that family so many years before that incident even happened, because a lot of those kids had so many traumatic experiences leading up to that, and trying to get them connected to resources and the resources they need sooner rather than later is the biggest thing for that group, I think.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we're still concerned about the meth and, you know, other substances in those homes, right? One of my pathologists, so Dr. Mary Case, She was the chief medical examiner in St. Louis for a long time, and she is just amazing at what she does. She put it like this. She said the meth, the heroin, everything else, it's always been there. So when we have a fatality of a certain nature, the kids are chronically exposed to some of these things, and we see that in the toxicology, whether that's causal to the actual death or not. Fentanyl, once you're exposed, it's so lethal. It's not there, it's the cause. So while some of these other things were always there, not the cause, this is the cause of death. And so it's so important to, I think we kind of talked about this earlier, when you take your baby to somebody else and they're like, hey, make sure they're in a safe sleep environment, right? I think it's really important to think about who you're allowing to watch your kids, where you're going with your kids, and who you're bringing into your caretaking environment. Because there were a few of these cases where the exposure was hard to identify because there were so many people in that caretaking environment, or the parents had no idea that they had brought somebody in the caretaking environment who was, you know, using or had fentanyl, and then the child was exposed. And so I think, you know, being full frame about where your kid is and who's around your kid, not only with safe sleep and fentanyl, but just in general safety, right? And we could talk about guns as well, and that, you know, making sure your child is always in a safe environment.
Yeah, for sure.
And the thing with fentanyl too is a lot of people don't even know they're using it, because so many drugs are just being cut with fentanyl at this point. And so fentanyl is in, you know, pretty much any street drug, it seems like, I think. And so people don't even know that. So they are having their own overdoses, we know that, but then it's also in the child's environment.
Yeah. And I like, that's a good point. And that's kind of on the same vein that I was thinking, you know, I'm thinking, how can we tie this back to our folks in FSD who work in resource centers, and they see a lot of our vulnerable population every day. I think just knowing the signs, I think it can be easy for us, for those who are not in children's division and they're not working with these families on a daily basis, it can be easy for it to be like, that's not my business, right? But there are signs of drug use or struggles. And so I think just those people that are seeing these families in resource centers, what can they do to be educated on those signs, or, you know, safe, like Narcan training? I guess what can we as a department possibly provide them, but what can they also do on their own to make sure that they're educated to some extent of what those things look like?
So I think you hit on it, right? When you said Narcan. Narcan training, knowing how to administer Narcan, and then always following up at the ED after, and being aware of signs and symptoms of overdose, especially it can look very different in a child. So having that level of awareness, especially when this is such a widespread community issue. I think, you know, one of the doctors we work with put it this way, she has an ethical, you know, idea, ethical, you know, reasoning to know where the AED is, right? When she's going to her kid's basketball game or whatever. Is there Narcan there? What does that look like when we're thinking about it out in the community? And so I think making sure you're aware enough to know when something's wrong, and then saying something, right? See something, say something. And if you know, we provide Narcan and Narcan training, if you feel comfortable, you know, helping and assisting in that moment. And then always, 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 I can't stress this enough, follow up at the ED after administering Narcan, or, you know, that person needs to follow up at the ED.
Yeah.
I'll just add,
I think, Go ahead, Colleen.
Tara, this is like our theme today.
That's okay.
Talking at the same time. I'll just add to that, just as another potential resource, our primary prevention workers are trying to connect with those resource centers, with our WIC offices, with some of those spaces where we know that there's a high chance of being able to educate prior to any kind of concern occurring. So I would really encourage community partners, resource center directors, whatever that might look like, to reach out to our primary prevention teams to see if we can't connect with them in some way to help provide that education. Because I think the overarching thing that I've heard is it is about educating, right? And making sure that we know what to look for, and then what do we do once we observe something? And who are the people that really can help us understand this? And while we don't have all the answers, we can certainly work together to try to like help increase our knowledge and awareness of these situations in a way that supports every person we come in contact with.
And I know the Children's Trust Fund has a lot of publications and resources available on their website that could be ordered or downloaded and put in offices and lobbies, just different resources, different tips. And one of the things that came out of the fentanyl case review that we're going to be working on together collaboratively to develop a publication specifically around fentanyl and access to kids and the dangers of that. But just knowing that, and just sometimes just having the information available, do people pick it up? Maybe not, but it doesn't hurt to have it available. And really, I think we all, when we interact with citizens of Missouri in our day-to-day work, regardless of what division you're in, do something that you could tie to child abuse neglect. If you just, our interactions alone can help prevent child abuse on some level. Having just, you know, saying just little tidbits of information can help prevent child abuse neglect. So if we think about, you know, our interaction as that actual kind of service to that family, you know, what can we do to increase awareness and give resource information out when needed?
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, it's just really important for all of our team members to know that in some way or another, you're making an impact. Whether you work in CD or FSC or DYS, like everyone here has a purpose and everyone's role has a purpose. And so it's like leverage that, right? Use your skills that you have in social work and leverage that. I do want to hit on the suicide piece. And I think, like you said, Kara, the report really kind of splits down between littles and bigs. So younger children and then older youth. And Haley also touched on really collaborating with DMH on that side of it. But I think we could also, you know, we have a lot of opportunity to also collaborate on the older youth and mental health piece also. So I think I would like to start the conversation of what do we do now for those older youth who may be struggling with their mental health and maybe having those suicidal thoughts? What, you know, for the families that we are involved in and, you know, we know this is going on, what are some resources that you all use every day to kind of help in that?
So I think we do our best to partner with the local mental health agency in the community in which that's happening, right? And getting that kid to crisis center where they can be adequately assessed. I don't think we go in as children's division workers and attempt to assess if a child's actually having suicidal ideation or not. We really work to link to the experts that can. I think a barrier to that is knowledge and education, right? So Elaine kind of keeps bringing us back there, because I don't know that locally our workers always know the right place or the right person to help these kids. And I think that's going to be a big goal from this group, right? So the fentanyl, when we reviewed the teens, we saw a lot of mental health problems in the history, potential previous suicidal ideation or attempts. and then, you know, ongoing addiction issues. And so when you have that massive undercurrent of mental health in these kids' lives, I think a huge effort we're probably going to be working on is working to make sure that worker that goes out to that home in this local community knows where the local mental health agency is, how to help this child, what service this child or family needs to really address this mental health issue. And I just wanted to add, in 2022, there were 42 Missouri children who died by suicide.
I just want to add to what Haley said. Like, this is such a big conversation, and it's just so hard because we are not mental health professionals.
Right.
So we can't diagnose, we can't treat signs of suicidal ideation, but we can be aware of what that looks like. Just like everything else we do, we need to be aware. And this is absolutely something that we need to focus on and increase our ability to understand it and the awareness of suicidal ideation, suicide prevention. We're working on a contract to be able to get some additional training for our workers to be more equipped to understand this piece of and then this challenge that so many of our kids face. And to Haley's point, really becoming experts in who we can connect these families and these children to. I would guess that it's probably not just a child need, it's a family unit need, right? So we're really getting to that root analysis of what we need to do to help this family function in a more successful way and really support these children who are struggling with their mental health. It is such a huge conversation and we can't talk about it enough. And I think that's one of the things that I try to debunk is talking about suicidal ideation is not going to create a situation where it's more likely a person's going to commit suicide, right? We have to talk about it and we have to make sure that we're doing the things to help support these families and make sure they feel comfortable reaching out for help before it becomes too late for these kiddos who are just struggling. Life is hard for kids. School is hard. The economy is hard. Families are struggling and we just need to be more aware of how we can help them and really task ourselves with becoming the experts in where we can help these people connect to get the help they need and sustain their ability to manage the crisis that they're facing.
Well, and I think there's a lot of opportunity within DSS, right? So further, of the 42 children that died by suicide in 2022, 45% of those were receiving Medicaid. So there's huge opportunity there. And, you know, when you think about this population, again, they're touched by us via Medicaid. And then also, when you think about the unique struggles that our foster youth have, that higher ACE scores, they are more prone to face potential suicidal ideation too. And so I think there's just a lot of opportunity in this space.
Yeah, I really like what you said, Elaine, about just being aware of what it can look like. At the end of the day, it can look like a lot of things. And it's a hard subject, right? Like there could be things going on that you're not seeing, and that's okay. Like, you're not going to be able to catch everything. But I think it's just being aware of those overarching signs that we typically hear about could really make all the difference at the end of the day. From your perspective, if there's like a big takeaway that, like, let's say, you know, you're one of our team members and you're listening in, and you're looking for that key takeaway of this conversation, and not really just this conversation, but the key takeaway from the overarching conversation around all of these topics, what would that be? And like, what would be like your action item from that takeaway?
I'll go first. I think it's really sometimes very easy to see these issues as somebody else's issues and not your own. I think some of our families you know, they thought too, oh, I'll never have a sleep-related fatality in my home. And so I would really challenge everybody, not only in their professional life, but in their personal life, to see their role in preventing child abuse and neglect. And what could that look like if it's the tiniest thing that you can think of when the neighbor's going to the lake, make sure you wear a life jacket. Anything like that, I think finding your role in the prevention of child abuse and neglect is the most important takeaway.
I really like that, Haley. I think that is just so important, is for us to feel like we have a voice that can really impact other folks when we are in a space and we know something. We need to be able to share that knowledge in a way that lands for folks, right? And with that, I think it requires us to be educated to understand not just what to look for, but then how to help them connect to a resource. So us becoming kind of experts in this space of knowing where to send people when you identify something that they might be going through that they need assistance with.
I think for me, a key takeaway, and, you know, because of my job, I'm always investigatively focused, but I think the key takeaway is that early intervention. The sooner we can intervene and provide, you know, assistance and education and awareness and resources, the better. So, you know, when we encounter a child, you know, when they are 5 or 6, and, you know, something has happened to them, what can we do for that child then to help them in the future? And really being cognizant, more cognizant of that.
Yeah. I think, like I said, I see like an overarching theme here between all of us. And just to kind of build on that, like for me, it's knowing that you are in the place to be an advocate for these children, for their futures, for their families. It's not always about being an advocate just for the child, right? It's, you know, you can be that person for their parents too. Just really caring, I guess, what our next generation grows up to be, and knowing that even though you're not their parent or you're not their family, like, you still play a role in that. So yeah, I really do thank all of you for joining me. I think it's been a really great conversation. I think there's a lot to, you know, be learned from this conversation. And I think there's a lot that we have to look forward to in our department's future. I will just put a little plug in. With April being Child Abuse and Prevention Month, I think this podcast will probably come out after Go Blue Day, which is on April 5th. But on April 24th, I do know the Children's Trust Fund will be hosting a Go Blue Walk here in Jefferson City. I know for our team members that are outbased from Jeff City, I understand you won't be able to make it to Jeff City for that, but go for a walk. Be with us in spirit. Plant a pinwheel garden. And of course, if your office has, you know, if you wear your blue or you and your office take a walk together, please take pictures and send it to us so we can share it with the rest of the department and on our social media. You can email those to us at dss.directorsoffice@dss.mo.gov. Okay. Thank you guys so much again for joining me.
Thanks, Bailey.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Our Common Thread. Join us next time as we continue to discuss the thread that ties us all together here at the Missouri Department of Social Services.